Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. To learn more about Allowed and how you can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The program you're about to hear from the Allowed Archives was produced in 2005. I'm going to read just briefly from a citation to George Packer, who was a finalist for the Journalism Award established in honor of Michael Kelly, an editor-writer for The Atlantic who was killed while covering the war in Iraq. 20 years from now, students looking for a definitive account of the troubled aftermath of the U.S. invasion of Iraq will no doubt turn to George Packer's deeply reported 20,000-word piece in The New Yorker. In pulling together many different strands of post-war Iraq, Packer provided an important service to Americans struggling to make sense of tumultuous times. Tonight, we're very lucky to have George Packer here with us to discuss his superb book, The Assassin's Gate, America and Iraq. John Powers could not be with us tonight, but we're very fortunate to have NPR foreign correspondent Mike Schuster to have a conversation here with George. George Packer has been a staff writer for The New Yorker since May 2003. In addition to his coverage of Iraq, he's written on the atrocities committed in Sierra Leone, civil unrest in the Ivory Coast, and the Al Jazeera satellite news channel. That doesn't mean atrocities at the Al Jazeera satellite news channel. Packer was awarded two Overseas Press Club Awards for his work in 2003, one for his Iraq coverage and the other for his reporting on the civil war in Sierra Leone. In his review of The Assassin's Gate, the usually argumentative Christopher Hitchens offers only praise, noting how Packer takes us through the argument about war that occurred within the administration, quote, giving an excellent account in particular of the way in which Vice President Cheney swung from the realist to the neocon side. And then Hitchens writes, the scene shifts to Iraq itself. Packer has a genuine instinct for what the Iraqi people have endured and are enduring, and writes with admirable empathy. His own opinions are neither suppressed nor intrusive. He clearly welcomes the end of Saddam while having serious doubts about the wisdom of the war, and he continually tests himself against experience. Mike Schuster, who will be in conversation tonight with George Packer, is a diplomatic correspondent and roving foreign correspondent for NPR. He's based here at the NPR LA Bureau. When he's not traveling outside the U.S., he covers issues of nuclear nonproliferation and weapons of mass destruction, terrorism, and the Pacific Rim. In the past 2 years, he's contributed many reports to NPR's extensive coverage of the Middle East, reporting from Israel, Afghanistan, Iran, and Iraq. His reports have also focused on India and Pakistan, the Central Asia nations of Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, and the Congo. So I think there's nothing we can't talk about here tonight. After tonight's discussion, we can all go home and watch Independent Lens, A Family at War, on PBS, in which an American family contemplates the loss of a son and a husband in Iraq. We'll note the questions that they struggle with. What is this war about? Why are we there? How will it end? Tonight, listen, ask questions, continually test your ideas. Please welcome George Packer and Mike Schuster to the Los Angeles Public Library.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Mike. This is George. And Louise is right. You're all very fortunate to have George Packer here to talk about his experiences in Iraq and his book. I read a lot of these books. There have been a lot of books written about Iraq since the American invasion, and George is the most thorough, most comprehensive, and I think best at explaining why the United States is where it is in Iraq and how it got there. So, let's start. The book is called The Assassin's Gate. George, what's The Assassin's Gate, and why did you name your book after it?
The Assassin's Gate, by the way, thank you all so much for coming. It's really great to see such a nice group. The Assassin's Gate is the front gate to the Green Zone. The Green Zone, as you all probably know, is the large area in the middle of Baghdad on the west bank of the Tigris where the Americans set up the occupation authority in 2003 and where now the Iraqi government as well as the U.S. Embassy are located behind many, many layers of security and fortification. I was interested in it because of the name. It caught my ear. It had a kind of literary sound to it, and I assumed it was about 1,000 years old, and out of the 1,001 nights, it reminded me of old Baghdad during the time of the caliphs. And it also looked that way. It's an arch. It's a sandstone arch, quite high. The first time I saw it, there was an American soldier on a Bradley fighting vehicle just below it, which gave the arch a certain fraught quality and captured the strangeness of the situation of Baghdad in that first summer really vividly. But what really began to turn my mind as I learned more about the arch was that I was wrong about it on both counts. It was not an old Iraqi name. It was the nickname of the American unit positioned there. They were Alpha Company. They called themselves the Assassins. And somehow this name had already become its currency in occupied Baghdad. Whenever I mentioned it to Iraqis, I would get a blank look, and then I would get a look of annoyance because it wasn't the first time they had heard one of their familiar landmarks given a new name by the occupation army. Nor was it 1,000 years old. It was about 10 years old. It was built by Saddam. One of the many monuments all around Baghdad. It's a city of monuments, most of them utterly grotesque, the modern ones. It's also a city of beautiful ancient monuments in states of real decay. So it was a misnomer for a mirage. It was an American misname for an Iraqi illusion. And I don't know what more I could have asked for by way of a symbolic title for a book than The Assassin's Gate. All this is explained in the first page or two of the book.
You told me that you've been to Iraq 4 times to write the book and that you went for the first time after the American toppling of Saddam Hussein.
That's right.
What did you know about Iraq before you went?
Less than I thought. I had read some Iraqi fiction. I had read especially some nonfiction by an Iraqi writer named Kanan Makia, who figures largely in my book and who some of you may know. He was the leading Iraqi dissident writer in the 80s and 90s. He wrote a book called Republic of Fear that was probably the best-known book about Iraq before the war. It certainly put Iraq as a totalitarian state on a Stalinist model in the minds of people who read the book. And Kanan was a large influence on my thinking, and perhaps too large, because when I got to Baghdad, I found much of what he thought had been true of Iraq was no longer true. And much of what he expected to be true after Saddam was not true either. So although Republic of Fear is a great account of Saddam and the Ba'ath Party, it's worthy, really, of Hannah Arendt. As a guide to what to expect in the future, it was actually counterproductive. And so I had a lot to learn when I got to Baghdad.
And it seems to me that you had to disabuse yourself of some of the things that Makia told you about Iraq and what Iraq would be like in order to see it clearly as a reporter.
Well, you know, Kanan Makia is a tragic figure, in my view, because he understood better than almost anyone just what the state of Iraqi society and even more of Iraqi psychology under Saddam was like. And you can find it all in Republic of Fear and in another book called Cruelty and Silence. He knew all of that. And yet, because he became such a public advocate for the war and really got quite deeply involved in some of the battles within the Bush administration, and I think made bad political decisions, he almost willed himself to forget it long enough to be able to speak the immortal words, which he will be remembered for, whether it's fair or not, more than any other, sweets and flowers. He was the Iraqi who told President Bush that the American troops would be greeted with sweets and flowers. Against everything he had written and known about the factionalism, the sectarianism, the effect of religious extremism, and just the effect of 35 years of the most brutal dictatorship imaginable, sweets and flowers were not going to be the greeting. And the tragedy is, because he wanted this so much, he willed himself, I think, to mislead himself and President Bush about what we were getting into.
The first four chapters or so of your book is a lot of reporting about how the United States made the decision to go to war, how this decision was made, who made it, where, and when. And at some point, you ask yourself the question, how did the United States go to war in Iraq? You're puzzled over it. Do you feel that you know?
I think it's for historians, and that's a very strange thing. It will really be argued over by historians for a long time. At one point, I call Iraq the Rashomon of wars, because it really is different depending on whom you're asking. Even within the top levels of the administration, Paul Wolfowitz's war was different from Donald Rumsfeld's war, his boss at the Pentagon. I think I could probably sketch out the overarching motive of the administration, which really is not about WMD, and it's not about the supposed connection between Saddam and Al-Qaeda, and it's not about oil. It's about a desire to remake the Middle East, beginning in Iraq, taking the toughest case, sort of the worst case in the Middle East, and realign it, transform it politically, possibly use it to undercut Saudi Arabia and the influence of Wahhabism, Saudi extremism in the region. Certainly oil figures in, because there was an idea of undercutting OPEC at the same time by withdrawing Iraq from OPEC. But in general, turning Iraq into the beginning of a friendly, pro-Western, possibly reasonably democratic state in the heart of the Middle East that would dry up the swamps of extremism in that part of the world. And that is such a grand, abstract, theoretical argument made at one point by Paul Wolfowitz, though, in an interview with Vanity Fair, that it would never have been enough to bring the country to war. And so they turned to the grave and gathering danger, WMD, Al-Qaeda. But I don't think that explains it.
You also do some quite good reporting, it seems to me, on the issue of ideology and the desire that many policymakers in the Bush administration had, even before coming into office, that they wanted an example to show the world of a muscular military American foreign policy. And you make quite a good argument that that was a prime motivator for the war, it seems to me.
Well, part of what I tried to do in the Assassin's Gate is to trace the origins of the war in the thinking of a group of thinkers, writers, officials who came to be called the neoconservatives. And that name will always be linked to the Iraq War, because the Iraq War was absolutely a test case of neoconservative foreign policy thinking. But they go back to the 80s and 90s. A lot of them worked under Reagan. A lot of them came to their foreign policy views sort of as Reagan-like hardliners on the Cold War. But once the Cold War was over, they, like all the rest of us, were sort of left wondering, now what? What's the shape of the world without another superpower? Their answer was different from the answer of either most liberals and most establishment Republicans, who were, in one way or another, saying it's time to pull back. We need a peace dividend. We need to begin to draw down our army. The neoconservatives had a completely different answer, which was, no, this is the time to expand our power. We are the sole superpower. Security around the world depends on our ability to exercise that power wherever we think we need to. And the icing on it was, and that will be for good. That will not just be about our securing strategic seaways and oil fields. It will be expanding American power in the interests of freedom. That was sort of the idealistic side of neoconservatism, which you can find in some of the speeches of Reagan, although the practice of those speeches was always a little bit less than met the eye during the speeches. But that was the thinking of a very small group. And the remarkable thing about this story is that a small group, if it's determined, focused, unified, and politically disciplined, can actually change history. And when George W. Bush became president, it wasn't all that clear at the time, but he had placed some of these people in the mid to high levels of his administration in some key jobs, obscure jobs, but important. For example, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. Whoever knew who was the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy under Clinton? Well, under Bush, it was a man named Douglas Feith, who actually became pretty well known because that job was an important job in the planning for post-war Iraq. On September 11th, they knew exactly how to react. They knew what they wanted. And on that day, I would argue that the president became one of them. He became a neoconservative on September 11th.
Now, they had ideas. You've written in this book that Iraq, you think, is a war of ideas. But they needed, those who wanted to go to war in Iraq needed information and facts to argue before the American public in order to make a convincing argument. And one of your early chapters you call Exiles. And others have also said that the Iraqi exiles were instrumental in providing information or disinformation about to the administration so that it could argue its case. What about the exiles?
Ahmed Chalabi is one of the most fascinating characters in modern history. He has remade himself over and over and over again. He was the son of privilege during the monarchy period of Iraq, from a very wealthy banking family in Baghdad with connections to government. In 1958, there was a Republican coup, and by which I mean small R Republican, and his family...
They overthrew the king,
The king, dragged his corpse through the streets of Baghdad, and Chalabi's family fled. Chalabi never set foot in Iraq between 1958 and 2003. He became a brilliant doctorate in theoretical mathematics at Chicago, where he met Albert Wolstetter, who was Paul Wolfowitz's professor. He met Richard Perle, who was sort of the impresario of neoconservatism. He met Paul Wolfowitz. He became friendly with the neoconservatives. During the 90s, he was involved in a scandal everyone knows about in which he was accused of fraud during the collapse of the Petra Bank in Jordan. He fled Jordan ahead of an arrest warrant. He was convicted in absentia. He still hasn't set foot in Jordan. Since then, he rebuilt himself by becoming the head of a new organization called the Iraqi National Congress after the Gulf War. And he went literally within about 4 months from being a wanted man in Jordan to the chairman of the Iraqi National Congress. He convinced the CIA to back him and to fund a coup attempt that we were talking about earlier in northern Iraq in 1996, which failed miserably.
And which the CIA blames him for, I believe.
Absolutely. And at that point...
Which is one of the reasons why the CIA is not so fond of Ahmad Chalabi.
The CIA and the State Department dumped him after that. The Clinton administration dumped him after that. He remade himself yet again. He went to Washington and very quickly found that he could make use of the political battles within the American political system by pitting his new friends, Richard Perle, Dick Cheney, Newt Gingrich, the conservative Republicans against the Clinton Iraq policy, which did seem to be failing. And he became the darling of the neoconservatives. He told them what they wanted to hear, which included democratic Iraq will recognize Israel. We'll rebuild the Kirkuk to Haifa pipeline. And he seemed to be almost too good to be true.
He also brought to them other Iraqi exiles that had other stories to tell about biological weapons, mobile laboratories, and nuclear weapons capabilities and things like that.
And he skillfully used both officials once the new administration came to power and journalists. I mean, the Judith Miller story is also the Ahmed Chalabi story. So there was this small group of people who were useful to each other. I'm not saying Chalabi is completely without principles. I think he actually does have principles, but the main principle is Ahmed Chalabi. And it was a mistake for, as one of my Iraqi friends told me about, a friend of Chalabi said to me concerning how Chalabi seduced the neoconservatives. They were young, they were naive, and he played them easily. He was a master politician compared to some of the young brains at the Pentagon under Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, and Feith. He remade himself yet again when he went to Iraq after the fall of the regime and found that he was no longer popular either with Washington or with his fellow Iraqis. He became a Shiite fundamentalist.
He became deputy prime minister of Iraq, which he is now.
That's right.
But he is actually in Washington this week for meetings with the Bush administration.
He's amazing. You have to hand it to him. I mean, he's a survivor, and he's no longer a Shiite fundamentalist. I think he's back to being a secular liberal in anticipation of the December elections, when he may well run as the hope for secular centrist Iraqis. So he is quite a figure, and someone should certainly write a biography of him.
The battle over this war between the Pentagon and the State Department is pretty well known. There's been lots of news reporting about that over the last couple of years. But you look at this closely in one of your early chapters, and I think it's one of the best explications of why the Pentagon gained control and why there was, in effect, no preparation. I won't say no planning for the post-war period, because other agencies obviously planned for it.
Yeah.
But that the Pentagon rejected almost all preparation for the post-war period disastrously. But I think your chapter explains better than anything that I've read elsewhere why that was the Pentagon's approach.
It was almost philosophically their approach. In other words, it wasn't an accident, it wasn't carelessness, it wasn't even just the bureaucratic infighting that was so crippling in the months before the war. It was that the people at the Pentagon, who had fought for and won control over the post-war, over the objections of the State Department, Bush signed what I think is actually the most important single document in the history of the documents that have led to the post-war disaster. It was called National Security Presidential Directive Number 24, January 20th, 2003. It's still not very well known. In it, Bush signed over control of post-war Iraq to the Pentagon, which meant that Donald Rumsfeld, the official who had less interest in post-war Iraq than any other across the top of the government, was in charge. The people under him, Wolfowitz, Feith, and then a whole bevy of sort of quasi-intellectuals in Feith's office, had no interest in rebuilding Iraq. They were against rebuilding Iraq. They were against nation building. It was a dirty word. Peacekeeping was a dirty word. Everything that had been learned from the difficult experiences of Bosnia and Kosovo and East Timor and Afghanistan was willfully forgotten, not by amnesia or a moment of forgetfulness, but it was philosophically unwelcome at the Pentagon and in the vice president's office, because he was the key ally for the Pentagon, to commit American troops, American money, American prestige to an effort to see through what was bound to be a chaotic aftermath. And so when the looting began in Baghdad, and Donald Rumsfeld in his press conference said, stuff happens, free people are free to make mistakes and commit crimes and do bad things, he wasn't just being his usual glib self. He was actually articulating a political philosophy, which was, it's not our problem anymore. They're free. Freedom is what happens when you remove a tyranny. I think that's the president's philosophy as well. Freedom is, as we all know, this divinely endowed thing that all human beings want. So you remove Saddam, and freedom is what follows, instead of what we all know follows, which is chaos.
What surprised me about what you found out about their thinking, and I don't think I had seen this anywhere else as clearly, was that they believed that they could pull most American troops out of Iraq within a couple of months. They had assumed a whole scenario about what would have happened, what was going to happen after the invasion in Iraq, that would allow the United States, they didn't tell the public this ever, mm-hmm. but that you write that they believe that within 3 months or so, most American troops would have been out of Iraq.
They believe that by September 2003, we would be down to 30,000.
This is extraordinary to me.
It is. And another little anecdote from the book. Rumsfeld's spokesman is a man named Lawrence Derrida, who really does carry the weight of the Secretary of Defense. He was sent to Kuwait in April 2003 to join Jay Garner's team. Do you remember Jay Garner? Sort of in over his head, but basically a decent and honest man who completely bungled the early weeks of running post-war Iraq. But before he ever got there, he was waiting in Kuwait for the word to go into Baghdad. And Lawrence Derrida joined his team in Kuwait. And on his first night there, one of Garner's deputies, who was in charge of reconstruction, said, we will need to show benefits to the Iraqis very quickly. And Lawrence Derrida pounded the table and said, we don't owe the Iraqis anything. We're giving them their freedom. That's enough. And then he went on to say, we plan on standing up a government, as they say, holding elections, and withdrawing most of our troops by September. Of course, the plan was for Ahmad Chalabi to take over the running of post-war Iraq, and that crumbled within minutes of the fall of Baghdad. But this was, Chalabi in this sense was very useful. He was the escape clause. He was the way we were going to get out of Iraq without having a commitment to what we had done there.
Now, so far we've not talked about your time in Iraq. You first went to Iraq in the summer of 2003 after the invasion was complete, after Saddam Hussein was overthrown, and after President Bush declared mission accomplished.
Yeah.
And obviously you didn't know all of this then, because you've
Absolutely
a reporter, you
not.
Continued to gather information over the following 2 years. What were your expectations when you first went to Iraq about Iraq and Iraqis and what the United States had done? And to what degree did reality change your view?
My expectations were far too high. I actually, although I understood it was a violent place, I didn't understand how violent it was until I got there. And you feel it in your nervous system once you're in the street. At that time, it was actually under sufficient control that you could move around Baghdad. I didn't walk around Baghdad, but I drove around, and I went wherever I wanted, and I talked to whoever I wanted, and I didn't really worry too much about... there had been no kidnappings at that point, so it was possible to work as a journalist. But I expected political parties to be forming, young people to be taking the opportunity to get involved in remaking society. I thought there'd be, I had this sort of fantasy that there'd be poetry festivals, that there'd be film series, that Iraqi artists would be coming out of the woodwork and their creativity would be bubbling up. And I actually had a nice little daydream about what it would be like. And Could I just read a little something that this will give a more concrete sense of what it actually was like? It didn't take long for my daydream to be popped, and I very quickly realized this is something else altogether, and I have to make this mental adjustment and take it in, rather than continuing to look for the poetry festival that wasn't happening. Iraq was restless and convulsive, as if liberation had introduced a virus into the organism and a fever was burning through the country. Day and night, the background noise was gunfire, and it grew especially intense after the 10 o'clock curfew, when no one who cared about his safety went outside. Now and then, the walls shook with a grenade or mortar round. The only force of order was the American military, but convoys of Humvees rattled through the city streets at speeds that had more to do with force protection than policing. Guerrilla attacks on soldiers were already occurring at a rate of 20 per day in Baghdad alone. One of the first things that struck me in Iraq was the look of the faces. I noticed it as soon as I crossed the border driving in from Jordan and saw a group of men hanging around the first filling station. Compared with the Jordanians on the other side, who, after all, were brother Arabs and probably members of the same border tribe, the Iraqis looked poor and beaten down. Their cheeks, covered with gray stubble, were leathery and hollow, their eyes downcast, and at the same time, quick and watchful in the way of people used to anticipating dangers and seizing furtive chances. They reminded me of the faces in post-war Italian neorealist movies, with the roles played by ordinary men and women wandering through the rubble of bombed cities in search of work. Even the frayed, long-outmoded jackets the Iraqi men wore and the eternal cigarette butts dangling from their lips looked the same. As a rule, Iraqi men always turned out to be at least a decade younger than my first guess, and this became a sort of bleak joke. I once rode in a taxi, the usual wheezing orange and white metal oven, and the driver asked my age. When I told him, he said, 42? 42? He drew the number with his finger on the dashboard, thinking he must have misunderstood my English. 42? He pointed at the digital clock on the dash, which read 5:41. This 41. You 42? Finally accepting it, he said in wonder, "You are beautiful." I knew what was coming next. Me? 43. It was my turn to be shocked. I had figured him for at least 60. I told him that he was beautiful too, but he wasn't having any of it. He pointed at the grizzled beard and the massive wrinkles on his face. Iraq, no good. That was what Iraq felt like that first summer.
Well, I've been there several times, and it's what Iraq feels like. Your book is populated by many characters. We shouldn't leave the impression that it's just analysis. There are a lot of real live Iraqis in your book, and they come to life. And I wondered whether there's one in particular you might want to talk about.
Well, there's a young woman named Asil, who when I met her, she was 28. She was working as a computer programmer at the university in Baghdad. And she simply stepped in my path one day when I was at the university and said, "I must go out of Iraq." And I felt, wow, this is a story behind this. And I ended up spending most of that afternoon back at her home with her family, and it was, they were this characteristic middle-class family that had lost almost everything because of the wars and the sanctions. And that is actually one of the backstories of Iraq today, that the middle class, which used to actually be very powerful and strong and secular in Iraq and outward-looking, gradually just got beaten down and beaten down. Its wealth and its political power eroded until by the time the U.S. arrived, they were the least powerful group in Iraq. And they have never really been able to seize the opportunity to make their own views known because they've been at the mercy of armed groups. That was her background. And she actually welcomed the war. For her, it was her only chance to have a normal life. She was 28, and she felt, you know, if the Americans hadn't come, I would have spent the second half of my life just as miserable as I spent the first half. But she was thwarted and frustrated by a lot of things. Fundamentalists in her neighborhood who kept insisting that she wear the veil and that, you know, she behave, you know, as befit a conservative Muslim. Kidnappers, she was nearly kidnapped twice. Baathists who still were hanging around the office where she worked. So there was this sense that it hadn't really changed. She still hadn't been freed. She kept taught, freedom was her favorite word. She used it over and over, but she always said she didn't feel free yet because Iraq had not changed enough for her to realize her dream. And on the last day I spent, on the first day I spent with her, the last day she said to me was, "Do you think my dreams will come true?" Which was a heavy thing to leave me with. So each time I went back to Iraq, I looked up a SEAL just to see how she was doing and what she thought of the changes in Iraq. And the last time I saw her was a few days after the January elections, this past January. I was in Basra for the elections, but I went to Baghdad afterward, and I met her, and she told me how she had voted. She and her family had walked about 6 miles because they had moved between the before and after of the fall of the regime, and their food cards were still registered in an old, very pro-Saddam neighborhood. So she put on her abaya.
And the food cards were the voter registration cards.
The food ration cards became the voter registration. She put on her black abaya and her running shoes and walked 6 miles with the last couple of miles quite tense because she was now in Saddam territory, in a neighborhood of Baghdad that was pro-Saddam. And she voted. And she voted for Ahmed Chalabi, which I tried to argue her out of. But she liked Chalabi because she thought he was most committed to getting rid of Saddam and the Baathists. And after the election, when we met, I'd never seen her quite looking this way. Until then, she'd always been a little bit hunched over, dressed a little bit drably. But in the 2 or 3 days after the election, when I saw her, she was wearing this royal blue suit. She had a new job in one of the ministries. She wore a royal blue suit with a skirt and makeup and jewelry. And it was as if she had kind of cast off the burden of her fear, at least for that moment.
There's an aspect of Iraqi life that you touch on. You don't address it directly, but in a number of chapters you touch on that I haven't seen any others write about. And that's sex in Iraq. I wonder, I got the impression that you, as you got to know some of your characters better, you always broached the subject of sex. You wanted to get some insight into how Iraqis viewed sex. And I think it's a good question because of Islam and the relations between men and women in Iraq. It was appropriate, I think, inquiry. And I wondered whether there's anything you want to talk about Iraqi sex life.
And no one has asked me that question. That's actually, it's a great question. It's true. I mean, when you spend enough time in a place, inevitably you want to know about that, right? What goes on here? You know, what's really happening? It seems awfully restrained on the surface. In fact, it was a far more conservative country than I had imagined it could be. I just heard secular Iraq. Women, you know, there was always a woman at the table when Saddam would have his cabinet meetings. You know, she was known as, what was her name, Mrs. Anthrax, I think, or something like that. She wasn't a nice woman, but there was a woman at the table.
There was a female scientist who was head of their biological weapons program, and I think they called her Dr. Doom.
Dr. Doom, something like that.
I think I was right.
I'm not sure. Yeah. Well, it turned out that she was the most liberated woman in Iraq because especially after the fall of the regime, when you have to imagine total chaos, no one is in charge. There are no traffic lights and there are no traffic police. If there's a crime committed, there is no investigation. if you want to steal somebody's property, as long as you have the guts to do it, you can do it. And that was what Iraqis were living with, to some extent still are living with, although less so. This was very bad for women, and especially because vigilante rule took the place of law. And vigilante rule meant the most powerful groups, which were the religious groups, both Sunni and Shiite. And so for someone like Asil, who lived in a Shiite neighborhood, for her to be out on the street unveiled was dangerous for her. And so one of the many paradoxes or ironies of the war is that our liberation of Iraq has left women more endangered and more, in a sense, repressed socially, although politically they are now 25% of the Iraqi parliament, so I don't want to make a complete case of it. Sex is a really taboo subject in Iraq. It was impossible for me to get women to talk about it. It was just too shameful. Men talked about it, and one of the men who was my sort of main sources on Iraqi sexuality was a doctor who worked at the morgue, named Bashir Shakir. His job at the morgue was forensic medicine. He had the really gruesome task of figuring out the cause of death of the dozens of corpses that came into the morgue every night, because that was the nature of violence in Iraq after the war. Before the war, all those corpses were buried in mass graves, so there was no forensic specialist to look at them. But so a different kind of violence. But the other side of his job, and this became clear to me as I got to know him, was forensic medicine on living people, which really came down to inspecting women for virginity. Because, as he said to me, if there's ever a crime involving a woman, whether victim, perpetrator, whatever, that's the first piece of information we have to have. And that showed me just how different Iraqi society was from ours. And to him, this was a man who in many ways was modern. He wanted to travel. His favorite movies were Cary Grant and Marilyn Monroe films. But he saw absolutely nothing wrong with a society whose cohesion depended on virginity, and where crime and virginity were so intimately related. For example, a corpse of a woman came in one night, riddled with bullets, and he did the examination on her and found that she did not seem to be a virgin, which was strange because she was not married. And this cast some shadow of guilt on the family, because perhaps this was an honor killing, washing the sin, as he put it, meaning the family found out and had to kill her. And that happens with alarming frequency in Iraq. So this is not a happy subject, sex. It actually leads to death with kind of alarming alacrity. It's not. There is an underworld. There is, you know, that people have affairs. There are brothels. There are young people. In fact, an interesting part of the sex is that young Shia pretty much have permission.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Given by Ayatollah.
By Ayatollah Sistani on his website to have everything except intercourse, because it's called Zawaj Muta'a. Pleasure marriage, meaning essentially their imam sets up a young man and woman for anything from an hour to a year or 10 years, in which money is changed hands like a dowry. Everything like a marriage takes place, except that there's a time limit, which basically means that the imam and the Shiite faith is cutting them a break, is basically telling them, we know you're young and you have these needs. We can't let you do everything, but here's how we're going to make your life a little bit easier. The Sunnis thought this was just rank hypocrisy. As one Sunni said to me, you know, better to be a sinner and admit it than to go through with this charade. But that was one weird little subplot of Shiism in Iraq that told me that a lot's going on under the surface that I don't know about.
Well, I think that the fact that you asked these questions and wrote about it was a really valuable insight, beginning to be a really valuable insight into what lurked beneath the surface in Iraq. There are many more things that I could ask you about. You spent a lot of time with Americans in Iraq, soldiers and government workers as well. If the audience has any questions along those lines, I'll let the audience raise that. And we're going to open it up shortly, but there's one other thing that would be good for me to ask you. One of your chapters is called Insurgencies. And in fact, there have been more than one insurgency in Iraq. You write about both the sporadic Shia insurgency and the ongoing Sunni insurgency. I'd say, for the time being, let's put the Shia insurgency aside. What I'd like to ask you is, as a reporter going back to Iraq several times, maybe talk a little bit about how you were able, or if you were able, to report on the Sunni insurgency, how you were able to get information about it, and whether you feel confident that you know who is fighting the United States there.
I was not able to get close to it. One doesn't want to get close to it. I mean, to get close to the Sunni insurgency means you've pretty much given up the idea that you're ever going to get out of Iraq alive. That's how dangerous the Sunni insurgency is for Iraqis and for foreigners. I never understood their media strategy. I talked to a Sunni who had connections to the insurgency, but was not an insurgent himself. And I asked him, why are your friends cutting off the heads of Westerners, killing journalists? Journalists are actually quite important for you, because as long as the deaths of Americans are on the front pages, and the deaths of Iraqis in these dreadful suicide bombs are on the front pages of American papers, the pressure to get out is going to be stronger. So why don't you serve them tea and hold press conferences? And he said, yes, it's true, we have some unreliable elements. It was as if he had bad business partners or something. And we try to moderate them and control them, but we can't. I think that the fact that they don't have a good media strategy in that sense, fear is their strategy. Terror is what they're best at, and they're very, very good at it. And I think it shows there's an element of nihilism in this, in a certain strain of the Sunni insurgency that doesn't look like Ho Chi Minh or Mao. There is no obvious politics in some of the insurgents' actions. And in that sense, it's very hard to defeat it, because as everyone knows, the only way to defeat an insurgency is politically. What do you do if you're dealing with an insurgency that, in a sense, is above politics? Zarqawi's statements show that any step toward politics is absolutely unacceptable. It's dangerous for him. So the answer is I don't know them. I don't know them, but I do talk to Iraqis who know them, and that's the only way I can get information, is one step removed from Iraqis who somehow managed to win their trust. And I'll just mention one Iraqi, a translator of mine, who managed to slip into an insurgent-held town called Haditha a couple of months ago. It's really in the middle of the Sunni heartland. That town had become a kind of Taliban-like reign of terror, with public beheadings and people being flogged for minor offenses against Islam, etc. So it was really quite a nasty picture of life under the most powerful of the insurgents, who I do think are the Islamists. I think the Ba'athists are now less and less the driving force. Ideologically, they're more spent. They're not recruiting young people to Ba'athism. They're recruiting young people to Islamism from all around the region. So I think the Ba'athists, although they may still be the money and the weapons and the training and the experience, I don't think they are the motor of the insurgency. What the head of the insurgency in this town told my translator was this: we know the Americans are going to leave sooner or later. And when they leave, we will be able to confront our real enemies, the Shia. And we'll be able to launch the final campaign of the war, which will be the liberation of Baghdad. That was a picture of the future as presented by one local commander of the Sunni insurgency.
So in that sense, they do know what they're fighting for. They're fighting for control of Iraq.
For a control of Iraq, that means, because as we all know, the Shia are the majority, and the Shia plus the Kurds are 80%. So what we're talking about is a group who think that through violence they can restore a fraction of the 20%, because let's not forget that not all Sunnis subscribe to this view, can take power back as long as they can wait out the Americans. Yeah, there is a long-term strategy. I'm not sure it's rational enough to be something that can be negotiated, though.
And maybe that suggests what their media strategy is. It seems to me if there is a media strategy, it flows from wider political goals. And if their political goal is to seize control of Iraq after the Americans leave, then the violence that's been used is not just, it seems to me, a signal to the Americans, but it's a signal to others in Iraq as well and to the Shia.
And people I know are absolutely terrified that there will come a day when hundreds of insurgents move through their neighborhoods and start going house to house, looking for anyone who either works in the Iraqi government, knows someone who works in the government, is secular, is Shiite, is Kurdish. Yeah, it is the nightmare scenario. And it's not impossible either.
Well, I think maybe it's a good time to open it up to members of the audience for questions. We have a microphone, and I think... do you want me to call, or you just want to... All right.
I'm trying to reconcile what you talked about as the overarching purpose of the war with your description of the people who were planning for, after the war, their disdain for nation building. And it's hard to put together a transformation of a state with a disdain for nation building unless you believe in miraculous thinking. Is that it?
That's it. That's it. The history of the Iraq War is was written by fantasists, by the willfully blind. In my book, I call them the criminally negligent. Criminal in the sense that this is negligence beyond what any reasonable person could would allow. It's not a moment's carelessness. It was a whole series of decisions made out of a fantasy that you could somehow change a regime without being responsible for the aftermath. I think that one thing this gets at is just how much this war and those architects of it were driven by domestic politics. And by that I mean a reaction to Clinton, to what they saw as his failures in Iraq and all over the world, a reaction to softness, as they saw it, in the Democratic Party, and a reaction to the cautionary voices within their own party. Because let's not forget, there were plenty of people, including the president's father's advisors, who were saying this is not a good idea. When you're sort of surrounded by enemies in that way, you harden, you become more rigid. And I think that happened to the neoconservatives. They always saw themselves as a beleaguered minority. When a beleaguered minority sort of forces their way to power, they don't tend to look around for sort of honest disagreements and thrash things out in an open way. No, they cut people out. They didn't allow any of the bad news, the bad scenarios, the pessimistic forecasts to get into their deliberations. They consciously left people out who were warning them that it might not be so easy. So when you have that those circumstances, you can have a, did you call it a fantasy or a miracle? Yes, a miracle. Exactly. That was it.
Over here.
Given the what you've described as the divisions in Iraqi society, you know, between the various factions, can you conceive of a scenario where when the United States went in, that we could have actually created a civil society if under the best of circumstances that would have held together?
It's a great question. Hard to answer just because it's counterfactual, but I certainly think we could have come closer. I think we did almost everything wrong. If we had done almost everything right, at least we would have given Iraqis a chance, because those were the people we truly betrayed. We could have given Iraqis a chance to show whether they wanted to live together, whether, given the rule of law, they were capable of building a democratic government, et cetera. Instead, violence has undercut every effort, both Americans and Iraqis, because there never was any rule of law. There may be some historical inevitability to the breakup of Iraq. I don't know. I really don't. I think these things have a way, though, of becoming self-fulfilling. The more people say Iraq is bound to break up, the more likely Iraq will be to break up. Just as the more people said, the Bosnians and the Serbs have been killing each other forever, the likelier it was that mostly the Serbs would go on killing the Bosnians. But actually, this is a moment to read something I just got today from an Iraqi woman who's a friend of mine. And here's what she said in an email to me. I had sent her an email saying, you know, Americans are really beginning to think that this is not going to work and we should leave. And here's what she wrote. Although they seem to disagree about almost everything, most of the Iraqi people don't want their country to be divided into states, believe it or not, because they believe that the division of the country will give the neighboring countries and other countries the chance to be involved in deciding the fate of Iraq, which is something no one wants. The majority of Iraqis just want to have a normal life like any other nation. They just want to wake up every day, go to work, plan for the future, and the future of their children and families, worrying about the simplest and usual things that any other population takes for granted. I guess we can handle democracy, but it has to be step by step. And without all this fuss that the media and politicians make, they're making so much out of it, and this intimidates people and makes them wondering and have second thoughts about the motives behind all this anxiety. We just need to make people understand that this is a normal process that happens in most countries. Well, don't give up, because we're not. I know that that's not really an answer to your question, but I can't think about Iraq without taking people like that into account, and I know that there are a lot of them there.
You touched on it earlier about... Do you think that the Ayatollahs over there might take control of the country itself and turn it into an Islamic-style country like Iran, or even join forces with Iran and becoming one?
It's a good question. When I was in Basra in January, Basra is the heart of the Shiite South, and it's got an interesting history as a port, and so it's actually rather cosmopolitan and used to be a place where Kuwaitis could go and drink. But Basra has fallen under very heavy fundamentalist control. And one man said to me, there's an indirect Iranian occupation here. You can't see it. They're not waving Iranian flags. But they've got offices, they have money, they have agents, and they're playing a very mischievous role in forcing Shiite politics in that direction. But, you know, I think that Iraqis have all sorts of reasons not to want to fall under Iranian control, the first of which is, back to this gentleman's question, there really is a historical antipathy between Persians and Arabs, and it's not an automatic that simply because they're Shiites on both sides that there's going to be an alliance. The other thing is the Shiite clergy in Iraq, don't subscribe to the Khomeini doctrine of Walayat al-Faqih, which is the rule of the clerics. It's alien in Iraq. The jurisprudence of the Shiite clergy in Najaf, although they certainly want a strong Islamic influence in the constitution, in law, in daily life, they've actually kept out of politics up till now. I think Ayatollah Sistani has been amazingly restrained in how he's he could be running the country right now. So I think there are reasons why it might not happen. I think what's likelier is there's just going to be, because there's lawlessness, there's going to be vigilantism run by Shiite militias and thugs, which is going to make life difficult for ordinary people, regardless of whether they've got the Iranian model of government.
Both Bush Sr. and Clinton's advisors feared the consequences of an invasion of Iraq. To what extent has the chaos that's been unleashed by this invasion realized their worst fears?
Yeah, I was once talking to someone at the State Department who also worked under the first President Bush, and we were going over all the things that were going wrong in Iraq, and he said to me, "Now you know why we didn't go all the way to Baghdad in 1991. What would we have done then? We would have had the country on our hands." You know, it's to me, there is no good answer to this one, because absolutely, the warnings of Scowcroft and of Baker and people like that are being borne out. Scowcroft has made them quite vocal in the New Yorker magazine just a couple of weeks ago. On the other hand, Scowcroft and Baker are also the people who looked, for example, at the killing that was beginning in Bosnia in 1992 and said, "We don't have a dog in that fight." They have a fairly cold-blooded view of American interests and essentially what goes on within the privacy of other countries' borders is not our business. That's known as realism in foreign policy circles. I don't think it's any clearer a guide to what to do in the face of a crisis than neoconservatism. It doesn't provide all the answers. I think it was the wrong answer on Bosnia. Leaving Saddam in power to slaughter the Kurds and the Shiites in 1991 was hardly a good outcome to the end of the Gulf War. And So it's a dilemma. It really is. And in fact, one thing the Iraq War leaves me with is a question of what kind of foreign policy should we have? The alternatives all seem bad. I think what we'll see is a move more and more toward isolationism. I think the country is exhausted, and there's a desire to simply pull back in. But then we'll regret that in 10 years, and we'll have to move back toward internationalism. So these things come in cycles, and they never seem to answer the hard questions that come up inevitably.
I have a question. There was a scene in your book where Senator Biden was talking to Clinton, and Cheney was in the office with him. And I forget what Biden was asking or presenting, but Cheney just interrupted and said, "No, that's not correct, Mr. President." Do you think that Cheney is making more of the decisions or has a lot of influence? And also, do you think that there's starting to be a rift between Cheney and Bush today?
I can't answer the latter. I'm not privy to their counsels, but you're absolutely right in what you're suggesting. I think Cheney was there at every turn in the Iraq policy and at every bad turn. Cheney certainly made the case about WMD and al-Qaeda connections more than any other official. Cheney was Chalabi's strongest supporter at the White House. Cheney was on board with all those mistakes the Pentagon made that Mike mentioned that are in the book. And now Cheney is using what little political capital he has left to argue, you know, against the little effort in the Senate to ban torture of American-held detainees. So he's a strange, dark figure. And And Brent Scowcroft said to my colleague Jeff Goldberg, you know, I've been a friend of his for a long time. We worked together under the first President Bush, but I don't know Dick Cheney anymore. I think he has been hugely influential, always covering his tracks, always invisible. One of my sources said to me, you would go into meetings and think a decision had been made and everyone had signed off on it, and the next day you'd find that it was 180 degrees the other direction, and it was always Cheney's office that was doing it. Cheney was the, what you might call the off-the-books national security advisor. No one could find his fingerprints. They couldn't find his traces, so he was able to work his will in a way that Colin Powell was just helpless to stop. Cheney, I think, is in a way the key to this whole story. I wouldn't minimize Bush's role and responsibility. I think Bush was, from 9/11 on, the driver of this war, but I think Cheney was the one who got his will done in the bureaucracy, defeated Colin Powell, kept the CIA at bay, and kept the Democrats on their heels. And so he has been indispensable for this. And we're going to, I think we may learn more about it as the Louis Libby case goes to trial. That may well be when we'll finally have the curtain lifted on the vice president's office.
Since you mentioned Colin Powell, for me, the tragic figure in all of this, how do you explain his role, his passivity, his almost pathetic performance through all of this?
It's hard to explain. I think he has a fatal combination of being a good team player who time after time decided not to make trouble for the president. I'll give you one example from the book. There were two officials from the State Department who were supposed to go to Kuwait with Jay Garner and his team to take over the running of post-war Iraq. And Donald Rumsfeld called Jay Garner into his office one day and said, you have two people on your team named Warwick and O'Sullivan. And Garner said, yeah. And Rumsfeld said, you gotta take them off the team. They can't go to Iraq. And Garner said, they're too valuable to lose. Rumsfeld said, well, this came from so high up that I can't do anything about it. Garner made a few inquiries. It had come from Cheney. Always, you know, hidden, but the man who was really making it happen. Why didn't he want them? Well, because they had different ideas about post-war Iraq, because they actually believed in nation building. O'Sullivan ended up getting back on the team. Warwick, who really knew more than almost any other official in the government about Iraq, was kept out. Colin Powell called up Rumsfeld and basically said, I know what you're doing, and two can play at this game, and I ought to keep every one of my people in the State Department out of post-war Iraq because you're messing with me in this way. But I'm not going to do it because I want us to succeed. This was the dilemma he was in over and over and over again, and he basically saluted and kept his mouth shut. At the very end of my book, though, there is a scene in which Powell goes into the Oval Office for the last time, January 2005, to say goodbye and finally tells President Bush what he has wanted to tell him all along. But it was too late by then.
I have two questions. One, in your opinion, did George Bush lie to the American people in giving the reasons why we went to war in Iraq? And two, there are those who say that Iraq is currently, if not in the throes of, a civil war. What's your opinion of that?
To the second question first, I think it's a low-grade civil war in the sense that in the streets of Baghdad and other mixed cities, there is ethnic violence, ethnic cleansing going on. People are being driven out of neighborhoods. Gangs are forming. Corpses are being found in the mornings, 10, 20 people. Those are the signs of a brewing civil war. It's not at the sort of full-scale level yet, but it's moving in that direction. And one question Americans will have to face as we debate withdrawal next year in the coming months is what effect that will have on that situation in Iraq. Did the president lie? A lie is a conscious untruth, I guess. And in that sense, I wouldn't say he lied, because I don't think the president understood the nature of the truth about all of this. Somewhere between a lie and an honest mistake, there's a dishonest mistake. And that's my heading for the pre-war intelligence. In other words, I don't think Bush was making things up that he knew to be untrue. But he was being told things, by Cheney especially, that were doubtfully true, or that were partly true, or where there was so much skepticism from another agency that any cautious president would have hesitated to say it publicly. Over and over again, he built the case for WMD on the basis of those kinds of dishonest mistakes, where although there was always some evidence, it was never strong enough that it should be presented without qualification to the public. And once you do that often enough, you've pretty much made a case, and I would say you've deceived the public. The word lie, I want to qualify it a little bit. I think there's a bit of revisionism going on now among those opposed to the war about just how conscious the deception was and just how obviously false the evidence was. I'm not cutting them much slack, but I want to be careful to make sure that the gray areas are there in the picture.
Hundreds of thousands of innocent children and women have been killed in Iraq from plane bombs dropping on them, our servicemen and women killing them. I cannot understand how we can be freeing a people and murdering them at the same time. My question to you is, did you meet some of these family members who lost their loved ones, their children, their mothers, their fathers, who were innocent? What tell us about the atmosphere of that, and what did these people tell you that America did for them that they appreciate?
Well, first of all, I have to quarrel with your numbers. They're wrong. They're far too high. I think the really best analyses of how many Iraqi civilians have died since the invasion are somewhere between 30 and 70,000, which is huge, right? But let's be careful about numbers. Of course, you can't be in Iraq without meeting people who've lost family members whose houses have been blown up by, whether by deliberation or by, I met a man whose house had been destroyed when the Americans accidentally set off a missile. You're absolutely right. You've got an occupation army in a civilian city, and the result is terrible bloodshed. Let's not forget the amount of bloodshed being caused by the insurgents as well, which is more deliberately targeting civilians than the Americans do. I want to be careful to make sure that there's no moral equivalence, because I don't think there is. But sure, some of them are Iraqis, but if you're suggesting that the insurgency is a kind of spontaneous outpouring of grief and anger on the part of ordinary people who simply want the Americans gone, there's some of that, certainly, but it's far too cruel to just be that. I mean, the insurgents are targeting children. They're targeting civilians. They're targeting mosques. They're targeting markets. They're actually going for the softest spots they can find. So what can you say to people who are in that situation? Of course. And this is the reason why the occupation, you know, has the support of like 2% of the Iraqi people. But the thing that I have to keep in mind every time I go to Iraq is it's never as simple as that. It never falls neatly into the categories of American political thinking. The neoconservative fantasy of grateful Iraqis is false. But the anti-war fantasy that Iraqis simply want Americans to leave their country because we're nothing but killers, that doesn't convey the whole truth either. And each time I've gone, I've tried to be as open as possible to the complex nature of the truth in Iraq, because it really is complex. And it's very hard to keep your mind around. I think that Iraqis are much more capable of living with that kind of cognitive dissonance than we are.
We're going to take one more question.
You had commented about the diminution of status of Iraqi women, and I was wondering to what extent was America responsible or involved in that? And then follow-up is there anything that we can do, or is this really completely out of our realm? Mm.
I think that actually the Americans were indirectly responsible for the vigilantism, that is the real threat to women, because there is no rule of law, there is no order, there's no security. That was our responsibility. We failed. But at the same time, you had all these American officials desperately trying to work with Iraqi women's groups to set up groups in rather inhospitable places like Karbala and Najaf. I knew of an American woman who was killed on the road between Karbala and Najaf because she was working with Iraqi women's groups. So once again, there's a kind of two-facedness to this. And if anything, women like that were thought by some Iraqis to be pushing too hard, to be interfering in traditional Iraqi society where they had no place. There are Iraqi women's groups. There's a network of them. And the way to get in touch with them is by an American group called Women for Women International. There's an Iraqi woman named Zainab Salbi who's the director of the Iraqi part of Women for Women International. And they desperately need support from outside. And this is one of the real tragedies of the Iraq War, that the people one would most want to see taking this opportunity, taking their lives into their hands, have been cut off from the world and have not had the support that they deserve. And it's hard to reach them. The violence makes it almost impossible to go see them, but there are always ways, and it would be terrible if they were simply forgotten and abandoned.
Well, George, it's been a pleasure to sit here and ask you questions and hear your insights and your experiences in Iraq, and I think the audience's questions were terrific as well.
They
Thank
were.
You very much.